Hi, this is Cale Clark. Welcome to The Faith Explained on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio mobile app. I'm so glad that you're with me today for this journey of exploring, understanding, explaining, and defending our Catholic faith.
You can email the program if you have a question, a comment, something you'd like me to cover, or a question you'd like answered. You can email me at faith, F-A-I-T-H, at relevantradio.com. And of course, we have a Twitter account too, which you can follow. My personal is at Cale Clark, C-A-L-E, Clark with an E. And the Faith Explained account is at Faith Explained. Also a good place to send your questions. And I have one here that comes to me from Donna in San Diego. And she asks, Cale, now that we're in the Easter season, what would you say are your top arguments for the resurrection of Jesus that would convince a skeptic? Well, that's a very good question, Donna, and I'm happy to answer that. In fact, it hits pretty close to home for me because, as you know, I've talked about this before, it was the resurrection of Jesus that convinced me that the Christian faith was true. I'd kind of wandered away from my Catholic roots when I was in high school, became an agnostic. I never became an atheist. I never stopped believing in God. I was always the theist. But I had some questions about what might be the true religion. I certainly had some doubts about the Catholic Christian faith. And so I was not practicing, and I was at the time attending Illinois State University, studying international business. We were looking at the North American Free Trade Agreement, which was a big thing at the time between Canada, the U.S., and Mexico. And some people from a local Baptist church, you know, this was a fundamentalist Baptist church, and they were fairly anti-Catholic in their doctrine. And these people had been taught that by their pastors, and I guess you could say they sort of came by it honestly, but they should have maybe questioned that a little bit more. But they knocked on my door, and they wanted to do a religious survey with me. And I knew what they were really trying to do. That was sort of a gateway to talking to me about faith and trying to convince me to maybe come to their church. And so I was definitely looking for a debate. I was searching for answers. And I invited them in. We started talking, and I started sharing with them my doubts, because my doubts in particular, and everybody has their own doubts about the faith, but my doubts were centered on history. Did these things really happen? Did Jesus exist? And ultimately, did he rise from the dead? And that's really the key question. And so I'm going to talk about what I learned from these guys that really worked for me. And I've continued to learn more about it through the years, because to me, the resurrection is the linchpin. And St. Paul is very honest about this. In 1 Corinthians chapter 15, he said, if Christ has not been raised from the dead, our preaching is useless, and so is your faith. We might as well eat and drink, for tomorrow we die. In other words, party on. There is no future. There is no hope. There is no life after death. But there is a lot of great evidence for the resurrection. And let's face it, as I said, it all falls or rises on this. And so I'm going to talk to you a little bit about how historians might look at this question. And when we're looking at history, when you're trying to convince something of a historical event, you can't prove it with 100% certainty, as much as we might like to do that. But what we can do is look at all the evidence that we have and say, what is the most plausible explanation for all of this evidence? And in light of the resurrection of Jesus, it might surprise you to know, and maybe delight you to know, that we have a lot of plausible historical evidence for the resurrection. In fact, I think the resurrection is the only thing, the physical resurrection of Jesus from the dead is the only thing that makes sense, makes light of the data that we do have. And I was really blessed during my grad studies to take a course with Dr. Gary Habermas, who was a visiting professor when I was doing my master's in theology. And he's probably the world's leading expert on the resurrection of Jesus. And he's been at this for a long time. Since 1975, he's put together this huge bibliography. And I don't know about you, if you've ever done a bibliography, it's not my favorite thing to put together, but he spent a lot of time putting together a bibliography, almost 3,500 works, over 3,400 books, academic journal articles, everything that he could find that was written on the topic of the resurrection in English, French, and even in German. And by the way, he's collecting stuff that he could find from anywhere, from anyone. Even if somebody is a non-believer or a skeptic or belongs to another religion or is an atheist or just doesn't care from a faith perspective, that didn't matter to Dr. Habermas. He wanted to gather everybody's points of view on this. And so what he found was that when he looked at everything that everybody was writing about the resurrection, scholars from all over the world since 1975, he's found that virtually everybody agrees on these five facts, these five basic facts. And Gary Habermas calls them the five minimal facts. And no matter what they believe about Easter, they all pretty much agree on these facts. So what are they? Well, number one, the fact that Jesus died by crucifixion. The second thing that they pretty much all agree on. Now, this is of the five, this is probably the one that's most disputed. There are some people, it's a minority, but there are some people who dispute this. It's the empty tomb. The fact that Jesus' tomb was found empty on Easter Sunday morning. Fact number three, Jesus' disciples believed that he rose from the dead physically and he appeared to them alive after his death. The next one, the fourth one, Paul, who at the time was, of course, known as Saul the Pharisee, who was involved in the arrest and perhaps even personally involved in, he was certainly an accomplice to the murder of the first Christian martyr, St. Stephen, might have been involved in some other deaths of Christians. Certainly somebody who persecuted the early church. Paul, at the time he was Saul the Pharisee, becomes Paul the Apostle. Something changed him. He converted. Paul's conversion, that's accepted by the vast majority of scholars, if not all scholars. Something made him convert. Something made him go from persecutor to propagator. And then the last one, the last minimal fact, is that Jesus had a very skeptical relative, very skeptical of who he was, what he was all about, before Easter, before the resurrection, and that would be James. After Easter, James becomes not only a believer, he eventually becomes the bishop of Jerusalem and a martyr to the faith himself. So these are five minimal facts that Habermas puts forward that the vast majority of scholars, no matter what their background, no matter what their beliefs, hold to with respect to the resurrection of Jesus. So let's talk about this a little bit. We'll get as far as we can today, but it's a good thing to talk about as we're in Easter week. We're in the octave of Easter. We need to look at the history of this because a lot of people are skeptical. A lot of people have questions about it. So let's just define what history actually is. And I'll use this definition for history. It's the study of reported past events in order to determine whether or not they happened. So let's look at how to do history here. Now, when we look at the history of the New Testament, what it says about Jesus, what happened to him, there's a few criteria that we have to use as to whether or not something is, in fact, historical. So these are five things I'm going to give you, five criteria that I'll give you that historians kind of use when it comes to the New Testament, Christianity, whether or not these things happened. Okay, so the first one is, it's called multiple attestation. That means that the event that is purported to be historical is recorded in more than one source, two or more sources independent. If you get independent sources, people writing independently of each other, they're not depending on one another's work, then that's considered to be more reliable. If you only have one historical source about an event, that doesn't mean that you throw the baby out with the bathwater. There are lots of events in history that nobody doubts happened, but we only have one source for them. For example, I think there's only one source for Caesar crossing the Rubicon, but it doesn't mean they didn't do it. So we can't just throw out one source if we only have one source. But if we have more than one, that's considered to be extremely, extremely encouraging as to establishing the plausibility of an event. The second thing is, it's good to have hostile sources backing up your claim. That's called enemy attestation. It's one thing if somebody who's friendly to your movement says, oh yeah, this happened. But, and this is one reason why people doubt the Bible, by the way. they say, well, Catholic Christians wrote the Bible. They wrote the books in the New Testament. So, of course, they're going to be biased. Well, it's true that they may have a bias, but they may believe this stuff because they have good warrant for this. They actually think it happened. They have really good evidence for it. So everything I'm going to say to you in this session and maybe in the next one too, none of this depends on the Bible being the Word of God. Now, I certainly believe it's the Word of God for sure. The Church says it is the Word of God. It's the divinely inspired Word of God. But a lot of skeptical people won't buy that. They won't believe that. They say, well, you know, I don't think these are holy books. That's okay, because you can tell your skeptical friend, all you need to do for the purposes of this discussion is to say, okay, the New Testament is a record of what the earliest Christians believed about Jesus. And most people will grant you that. They'll say, okay, I don't necessarily buy it myself, but I'll grant you that this is what the early church believed. And that's all you need to do at this point. The argument as to whether or not it's divinely inspired, that comes later on. That comes later on. But let's just say it's a source about what Christians believe. So that would be considered a friendly historical source, the New Testament documents. But there are also hostile sources. And if you can find this, if you can find what's called enemy attestation, if you can if you're debating someone, if you can get your debate partner to grant, if he's your opponent or she's your opponent, to grant part of your argument, that's fantastic, because they're making the case for you. If you're in a court of law, if you can get the opposing counsel to grant part of your argument as being true, that is fantastic. That is gold. So that's number two. The third historical criterion, we're just kind of setting the stage here for what we're going to talk about when we look at the events of Easter. It's called embarrassment, the criterion of embarrassment. And what does that mean? If a story or part of a story is potentially embarrassing to the people who are trying to say it's true, that's more than likely authentic. That's more than likely authentic. Why? Because you're not going to make up a story that's going to make you look bad. So that's number three. The fourth thing is eyewitness testimony. Eyewitness testimony. If you can get eyewitness testimony to a purported historical event, that's what you're looking for. Secondhand sources, well, they have their place. If you're in a pinch, you know, secondhand sources aren't necessarily wrong. But if you can get eyewitness testimony, for example, in solving crimes and trying to prove a crime happened in a court of law, you want an eyewitness to the crime. And so, are there eyewitnesses to the resurrected Christ? That's what we're looking for here. And then the last thing is, you're looking for something that's close to the event in time. If you have a written document or a testimony from somebody that's very close to the time when the thing happened, it's more likely to be reliable. It's more likely to be trustworthy, because people's memories can fade over time. If you encountered the resurrected Jesus, I don't think that's something you would easily forget. But nonetheless, over time, people's memories can maybe be faulty and fade. Or there's that common complaint that's often thrown at the church that it's kind of like a game of telephone when it comes to the life and career of Jesus. The eyewitnesses saw something, they told other people, they went and in turn told even more people, and it becomes like a children's game of telephone where the message gets corrupted, hopelessly corrupted, over time. So that's what's alleged happened sometimes by critics. So it's really important that we get as close to the event as possible in our historical sources about what really happened or what didn't happen. So having set the table for you, let's look at, those are the criteria that we're going to look at: multiple attestation, multiple sources, friendly and hostile testimony that backs up that this thing happened, even from the enemies. Embarrassment, embarrassing things are more likely to have happened. Number four, eyewitness testimony is key. And then something that's close to the event, number five. So keep those criteria in mind as we go through the five facts that Dr. Habermas puts forward, that the vast majority of scholars all around the world agree happened as historical facts. So the reason why we're doing this, by the way, is because something has to explain these five facts. And I think the best explanation for this is the resurrection of Jesus from the dead, the physical resurrection of Jesus from the dead. Now, if you're going to come up with an alternate explanation, it has to explain the data that we have. It has to explain these five facts better than resurrection. And I don't think any alternative argument can do that because it doesn't account for all the facts. So let's look at fact number one, the fact that Jesus did die by means of crucifixion on a Roman cross. Now, some of you might say, well, duh. Yeah, of course, people believe that Jesus died on the cross, but not necessarily. Not necessarily. You might be aware that Muslims, and quite a big chunk of the world's population holds to Islam, Muslims do not believe that Jesus died on the cross. They believe that God would never let that happen to Jesus, who they view as merely a prophet. But they think that God switched the bodies, if you will, and that someone else substituted for Jesus on the cross. The Romans thought they were crucifying Jesus, but it was actually somebody else. Maybe Simon of Cyrene, or there have been some other people who have been put forward as the ones who actually suffered on the cross. They were somehow made to look mysteriously like Jesus, so they thought they were killing Jesus. So Muslims don't believe that Jesus was crucified. There are other conspiracy theorists out there. Some who even say that Jesus didn't exist, although they're in the vast, vast minority. You should understand that. It's very hard to find anybody who actually holds to this. In fact, some years ago, a professor of history, a PhD in history, put forward a challenge on Facebook. And he said, if you can find me anybody who holds a PhD in ancient history, not just some random guy with a blog, but somebody who has a PhD in ancient history, an accredited scholar, who thinks that Jesus didn't exist, I'll eat a page out of my New Testament. And so far, nobody's ever taken him up on that because these people can't be found. That you will not find anybody, no matter what their belief is, who's a legit historian who will tell you that Jesus didn't exist. So they're very, very rare. But you will, from time to time, come across people who hold this. And it's important to establish that Jesus was crucified because if he wasn't, then it's hard to establish a resurrection, because in order for a resurrection to happen, there has to be a death first. So here's some facts about crucifixion. You should know that, and I talked about this a little bit on a previous special episode of The Faith Explained called The Truth of the Triduum, and you can look that up on the Faith Explained page on relevantradio.com. You can also look it up through the app. I looked at Holy Thursday, Good Friday, Holy Saturday. I looked at all the events of the Passion. So I did go into this in some detail. So I'll just summarize a couple things very, very quickly. Crucifixion was a very common form of execution used in the Roman Empire. There are various methods used. People were crucified in different ways, to different types of crosses, in different positions sometimes. Sometimes people were tied to the cross. Sometimes victims were nailed to the cross. And quite often before the victim was even crucified, there would be a very severe flogging that would be administered to that victim. So there's actually archaeological evidence of crucifixion. And I had the privilege of, on one of my educational visits, study visits to the Holy Land, to visit the man who's called the bone collector, as it were, in Israel, and that's Dr. Israel Hershkovitz, that's also his first name, at Tel Aviv University. And he has in his office the remains of a first century crucifixion victim, a man named Yehuhanan, or John. And by the way, he was crucified during the reign of Pontius Pilate, just as Jesus was. And the nail, the iron spike with which fastened him to the cross, they were unable to extract it. Sometimes it was very difficult to find evidence of crucifixion victims because the Romans didn't really care about sanitation when it came to killing people. They would often use the spikes again and again on the next victim. But in Yehohanan's case, we actually have the spike, the first century iron spike, and part of his heel bone, because they couldn't extract it. It had fish hooked, and we're not quite sure why. It's possible that when nailing him to the cross, the spike hit a knot in the wood and fish hooked, or perhaps it went through the wood of the cross, and maybe as the cross was laid down, there's lots of limestone in Israel, certainly true in the first century as well, and perhaps the spike fish hooked when it hit the limestone on the other side of the cross. We're not quite sure. There are some theories about that. But I've seen this. I've held this evidence of first century crucifixion in my hand. Also, he has in his office, Dr. Israel Hershkovitz, has evidence of the crucifixion of Mattathias Antigonus. Now, I don't know if you've ever heard of him, but he was the last Hasmonean ruler. It was a very famous Jewish clan. And this guy, boy, I talk about adding insult to injury. Mattathias Antigonus was crucified and decapitated as well. I don't want to gross you out here, but there have been lots of other nails, not as much as we might hope for, but there have been dozens of other nails that have been discovered in ancient Jewish tombs. And some ancient Jews would actually use these later on as magical amulets. Some Jews were very superstitious, not all by any stretch of the imagination, but they thought that crucifixion nails were very important. And so there are some actual archaeological artifacts of crucifixion. We also have ancient writers who wrote about it. Cicero called crucifixion the most cruel and disgusting penalty, the worst extreme of torture. And he also called it the terror of the cross. It was known as the terror of the cross. Josephus, an ancient historian of Jesus' times, who lived around the time of Jesus, talked about it as the most pitiful of deaths. In fact, they had to create a new word for it. The word excruciating comes from crucifixion. It literally means out of the cross. It was so bad they had to invent a new word for its horrors. And so historians also note, there's lots of writers who write about this, that the flogging that people would receive prior to crucifixion would often kill the victim before they ever got to the cross. And that's why I don't think that Mel Gibson's film, The Passion of the Christ, I don't think it went overboard. And that came out in 2004. I don't think it went overboard in its description of the flogging of Jesus. A lot of people thought it's way over the top. I don't think so. Shimon Gibson, who is an archaeologist that I worked with in Israel on a dig there, on an archaeological dig, he talks about the flagellum that was used by the Romans. And that was a stick that had leather cords attached to it, or thongs. And in those thongs, it was also called the cat of nine tails, there'd be pieces of bone, glass, iron, that'd be embedded in those leather thongs. And so that would literally rip the skin apart. It's one thing to be whipped by this device, but the pullback was even worse. And so lots of ancient writers like Josephus, like Philo, like Livy, like Dionysius of Halicarnassus, they write about flogging in the ancient world at the time of Jesus. In fact, Lucian talks about a guy who was not only flogged, but he had his eyes gouged out and his tongue cut out before he was nailed to the cross. It's true in the Christian period as well. The martyrdom of Polycarp. Polycarp was an early Christian martyr. And in that second century work, it talks about people whose flesh was torn open by whips. And that would be, of course, the flogging. In fact, their veins and arteries would become visible because of this. And again, this isn't to turn your stomach, but it just simply means that when someone was flogged, before they were even crucified, they would suffer massive blood loss, terrible pain, and sometimes they would die just from this. And so it's important to know what historians write about crucifixion. The Romans were really, really good at executing people. They would certainly know whether someone was dead on the cross. And in fact, that's why the New Testament reports that on Good Friday, when Jesus was crucified, soldiers came to break the legs of the crucifixion victims. Jesus was crucified with two others, as the New Testament tells us, as the Gospels tell us. And it was very important to the Jewish religious authorities in Jerusalem to get the bodies off of the crosses prior to sundown, because once the Passover feast started, that would be seen as defiling the land. You've got to get those bodies buried. And so what would happen would be very often crucifixion victims, their legs would be broken as they were on the cross, because what actually kills you there is you can't breathe. You need to lift yourself up to breathe, push yourself up to breathe, which would also be excruciating with the spikes through your feet, and think about the nerves that would be just pounding with pain as you tried to do that. So what actually kills you on the cross is eventually asphyxiation. You just don't have the strength to lift yourself up to breathe anymore, take a breath. So breaking the legs would hasten death on the cross. And Jesus was already dead. That's why they didn't break his legs. And that also fulfilled an ancient prophecy. And so that's why his legs weren't broken. But the coup de grace was the Roman soldier running him through with the lance, piercing his heart. Blood and water comes out. That's an actual medical condition. A sac of fluid forms around the heart under this stress. And it would have appeared to bystanders as if blood and water was coming out, just as the Gospel of John tells us. But all of the New Testament Gospels, plus the writings of St. Paul, the letters of Paul, they all are first century documents that say that Jesus died by crucifixion. Not to mention, by the way, there are some secular writers who wrote about it as well. Now, those who say that, for example, Muslims who say that Jesus was never crucified, in the Quran, the Quran is a 6th century document. I'm going to trust the first century documents every single time on this front, because they all say that Jesus died by crucifixion. Josephus talks about it. Tacitus, a Roman historian, these guys aren't Christians. This is enemy attestation here. Lucian of Samosata in the 2nd century, a Greek writer, talks about it. Maribar Serapion, another Roman writer from the 2nd century, talks about this. The Jewish Talmud. These guys don't believe in Jesus as Messiah. They all independently write, outside of the New Testament, about the death of Christ. Now, here's the bonus here. These non-Christian writers also authenticate the fact that Jesus existed. If he was crucified, he certainly existed. So you're getting kind of a two-for-one there on that front. So enemy attestation here in early, early first century documents. Eyewitnesses are named here in these documents. So this is a really, really good thing to do. Apply these historical criteria to the crucifixion. It comes through with flying colors. In fact, John Dominic Crossan, who's a very skeptical scholar, he doesn't think Jesus was resurrected. He's an ex-Catholic priest. He even wrote, "The fact that Jesus was crucified is as sure as anything historical can ever be," end of quote. That's all the time we have for today, but if you have a question about the Catholic faith, I'll try to answer it on the air. You can send it to me via email. The address is faith@relevantradio.com, faith@relevantradio.com, or you can try to get your question to me on the X app. My handle is @CaleClark. I'll be with you later today at 5 p.m. Central for the Cale Clark Show live on Relevant Radio, and I'll see you in the next episode of The Faith Explained. God bless.